easily train and protect your firefighter crew to NFPA 1851 standards. With effective washer extractors that sanitize PPE, simple record keeping, and proper training on how to be NFPA 1851 compliant, UniMac is called on by fire crews everywhere. Get details at unimac.com/cleangear.
Welcome to Tailboard Talk with Dane Carley, Craig Nelson, and Jeff Wallen. Every month we explore different topics of interest to you, our cohorts in fire and emergency services. So whether you sit back and listen, sound off on the message board, or call in live to be part of the conversation, we welcome you to join us in our mission to improve the fire service for those we serve and those we serve beside. Now coming to you live from the Great White North, this is Tailboard Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
Welcome to Tailboard Talk for Friday, July 17th. I'm Jeff.
Craig.
This is Dane.
And yes, here we are back in the Rural Recording Studios.
We are. Yeah, we didn't even do it.
No, yeah. Live in person. I don't know if you can tell by listening to us that we are all 6.7 feet apart in our individual
yep.
pods.
Yeah.
I'm talking to you right now with a mask over my face, and doesn't it sound great if you only had a mask like I have on?
Yeah, that's one heck of a microphone on that system to pick that up so well.
It hooks right into the exhalation valve on the mask, okay. Which is really great, and you hardly ever hear any of the stuff on it. I don't know how they build it.
That's good.
Yeah. It's not even Chinese. It's Taiwanese.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. Step up.
Well, the best part is when you ordered now, you got another one for free with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just I had to pay a separate handling fee that I got, too. Yeah, it was great. I was up late. You know, I was blowing off steam from the work week. I had a couple drinks. I looked at it and said, this thing's exactly what I need.
That's what I need
else to do,
to do the radio show. And you know what? I need to get one for Craig and Dane, too.
Oh, yeah. Does it have Bluetooth? If it has Bluetooth, I'm sold. Nice, but we got summer weather going on.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but my son is back playing baseball again.
Yep, my boy
in a limited capacity,
week.
So we got some social distancing going on in the stands with the parents.
Yeah, they won't let us in the grandstands, but we can all crowd out in the field along the fences. And
oh, chairs. So you can sit on top of each other in your bag chairs. But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The rules are kind of different from place to place. We can still socially distance in the stands where we're from, and pretty much most people are doing that from what I've seen, but as long as there weren't too many people watching the game, you're kind of doing that anyways.
Yeah, we've actually had, I would say, about twice as many parents, and people just don't even have kids playing, just coming for something to do. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. So there's been a good crowd at the games, and they're all doing their thing.
Yeah, it seems so normal, it's weird.
Yeah.
To see some kind of activity that's not involving wandering around Menards.
Right, or other random stores, or we'll see where it goes.
Yep, I'm sure time will tell.
Yeah, I think most states are on their way up, and
by the time people are listening to this, we don't even know. That's the end of the week. By the time we get done recording this, we're recording a few days early, and by the time you're playing it back, gosh, who knows?
Just yesterday was it? Yesterday wasn't it? Florida. Florida was its own country, would have been the fourth highest number of positive cases in the world.
I saw that this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, and wouldn't have expected that 2 weeks ago, and you have no idea what we're going to be dealing with 2 weeks from now. So it's that part is maybe been more stressful for our members to deal with than anything else is the uncertainty.
Yeah.
About how long it's going to go. Because, you know, at the beginning of this, we all felt, all right, we've got 2 months. Maybe three tops that we got to ride this out. And, of course, pre that, in the ever-changing reality of what we figure out this is, you know, we've seen this before with SARS. We've seen this before with Ebola. We've seen this before with Ebola Mark II.
HIV,
and so, you know, the things come in, they start to blossom, and spring comes in, and it all just piddles out maybe in one state, or it doesn't quite get here. We get a few cases, and it's done. So going from that to now we just need a couple months. If you look at what happened in China, we should be good in 2 months. So give us three. I never would have expected we'd be here now, and you just can't follow a predictable curve with all this either. So,
no, and nothing's really changed from where we were in February and March. We still don't have a vaccine. We still don't have a great treatment for it. We still don't we don't even know exactly for sure how it's transmitted. I mean, just was it last week they said something about it being aerosolized? And, you know, so they're learning stuff. I mean, not that we know more about it than we did in February, March, but we still don't have anything in place to change the circumstances.
True.
If that's,
you know. And still determining some of those initial factors, whether are you susceptible to a second round of infection? If you do get antibodies, how long do they last?
Long-term effects.
Right.
What are they? Just learning some of those, too, and finding those may be more dramatic than what we thought and longer lasting.
Right. So,
yeah.
But I guess one thing we are struggling with on our end, fire department-wise anyways, is trying to figure out how do we continue in the presence of COVID for the foreseeable future. So what work processes do we readjust? What habits do we try to unlearn? What new habits do we try to develop without losing the social element, without losing the level of service, without losing our proficiency, because we're doing very few things the way that we were a year ago.
Right.
But I don't feel that we're comfortable with the way that we're doing things right now. Not just that it's different, but is this the way we would truly? If we started from scratch and said, invent a situation where you're going to have this and it's going to be here this long and it's going to be this unknown for this long a period of time, we wouldn't have taken all the in-between steps that we've taken between there was nothing and where we're at today, because everything has been based on what we thought was going to happen and then what we thought was going to happen next, and then, oh, I guess it's not that what we thought would happen. So it seems like we're still playing catch-up in a way of trying to design what do we do for 12 months. And how do you know that 2 months from now that plan isn't going to get shot totally out of the window?
Right.
Again, too. So, yeah, just kind of a weird thing, and I don't know. I guess I've gotten a little more used to the uncertainty of it. Well, we'll just see what happens.
And I kind of wonder if it won't even be more down the road from here as we start to maybe not come out of this, is because we've ramped everything up. So I don't see us changing much with what we're doing response-wise, even in the stations. We've pulled back some of it, but we're still supposed to be maintaining the distancing, wiping down the stations, taking temperatures, and then when we go on medical calls especially, then wearing masks, wearing gowns, wearing face shields, all that stuff. I kind of worry about the when it starts to set in that this isn't going away now, because I think a lot of our folks have been, and myself included, kind of just like you said, Jeff, with that belief that, yeah, 2-3 months, boy, 4 or 5 if it gets really long. And now we're starting to hear about football seasons being canceled. High school football in Texas being canceled is a big play.
Holy smokes, I hadn't heard that.
And
in some ways bigger than the NFL.
Yeah.
And college, yeah. And some of the now the college, some of the college conferences are canceling. And now it's starting to kind of get in the back of your mind. Uh-oh, this could be through the fall, through the winter. And we, not too long ago in the last few weeks, have had some of our personnel asking, do we still need to do this? Can we back it down? Because our city is backed down a little bit, what they're doing, reopening the doors to the public and so forth. And again, I've been of that same mindset. Yeah, hopefully we can back this down. And now you start to get those little dark flickers in the back of your mind that this might not be backed down for a while. And
you realize that hospitals have not been able to back down. They have opened or closed various wings and programs based on anticipated need, but that they are fully operating in the presence of COVID and have, just in different levels and degrees. And it's hard to realize that we are part of that system. As healthcare providers, most fire service folks, we have to live within that realm too. And we have to provide fire and other rescue services and other services in the presence of COVID. And we have a monopoly. And so the other thing is even if we feel more comfortable being out in the community, that doesn't mean that the community would feel comfortable with us coming into their homes, their apartment buildings, their places of business when we have to come to do the things that we do. And they don't have the choice of saying, well, if I don't like the mask policy that just went into effect at Menards, I'm going to go over to Home Depot. Screw it. I'll shop there. I'll show them. When they call 911, they get the provider they get. They have no choice and no say. And that also dictates some of the things that we do as well, too, knowing we have to serve our diverse client base and the folks that have concerns, genuine and otherwise, across the spectrum. So it leads us to do things that maybe we think are overkill, but it might not be overkill to our customers. So,
right.
And you can have one customer on one side of you who is thankful for the thing that you're doing that day, and the other customer who can be throwing insults at you because you're buying into the whole illusion of having to operate safely. Right. And vice versa. So you back it off a little bit, and then you get this person saying, I'm glad to see you don't feel like you have to do that. Another person over there is completely psychologically distraught because you're not doing something safe. So.
Right.
Hmm. That's exactly the lighthearted stuff.
Yeah,
that
I was going
to
say that.
The show
yeah,
with.
So maybe awesome maybe we can
about.
Turn
deep thoughts
turn this
right
into a little bit more positive conversation.
Right,
Dane
well.
Sent us a YouTube video, and I think Dane probably could introduce it best.
First of all, I told Dane that I shouldn't be getting that on my work phone, and I told him please send it to my personal phone. And then he sent me the one that was about the show today. So I appreciate the first one, but you know. Say they follow it. The second one was pretty good, and I think we could use it on the show.
Okay. Which was it? I guess to back up a little bit, it's a TED Talk was one of the ones, and it's Amy Edmondson, and we've talked about her a little bit. We've touched on some of her stuff at different times, but she talks about building a psychologically safe workplace and the teams, how much more successful the teams are when they create an environment that feels like everything you're doing is about learning. So, you know, she started off, just to kind of summarize a little bit, that when she was doing some research, the hospitals where she was doing the research in that had the highest reports of near misses, so to speak, accidents, mistakes, errors, whatever you want to call them, were the hospitals where she would have actually expected not to see that. And through her research, she found out the reason those numbers were higher is because there was more of a learning environment. The people were more comfortable reporting errors and mistakes so that everybody else could learn from them. And that's kind of the gist of it. And so, you know, it's an important concept in the fire service, especially in the near-miss system, has it's still trying to get some... grow some wings, I guess you could say, is still trying to take off. There's been some hiccups with that, but the near-miss system that's been put in place would be hugely helpful. And it's been in place now for, what would you say, Craig? I think 2004 was that when that started, do you remember?
Boy, yeah, that's... I think, yeah.
That sounds about right. I think it's about 16 years, yep. And we're still struggling in the fire service, in the U.S. fire service. Mm-hmm. Not in the wildland side's got a pretty good system. The aviation has a pretty good system. For some reason, the structural fire side is just struggling to keep that system going. But it's along the lines of what she's talking about on a national level. And I guess, so, you know, at the department level, there's two different things that I think would be interesting to talk about. One is, how do you build that? And the other one that Craig and I were kind of batting a little bit before we were recording is, how has the fire service already changed? Have we already made some of those changes? And if so, how big are those changes and stuff like that?
You said that they didn't expect to find that there were a high degree of error rates with the group that they did. Why was that? What's some of the background about why that was a surprising finding?
Well, she was looking at, and I'd have to, I think it was about 7 hospitals, maybe 9 hospitals. Mm-hmm. And they were all fairly busy hospitals. They were medium-sized hospitals, and she had an error rate for each hospital. And the hospitals where she, because they had a good reputation, or because they because it's the processes they had in place, she felt were good processes. She expected the error rate to be lower. Were actually the ones that had the higher error rate.
Right. So the staff were recognized perhaps as being more qualified staff or more accomplished staff.
Yep.
Higher-performing organizations, you might say.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so she felt like she actually recognized that she was biased, because she recognized that she'd already had a preconceived notion of which hospitals should be doing well, and she was kind of
just trying
surprised
to
by the data.
Yeah.
So she had one of her research assistants, a graduate student, and she didn't give the student any background at all. She just said, here's the numbers. This is what I'd like you to research. She had this research assistant do the research. And through, long story short, the hospitals that had the highest error rate were that way because... the staff was comfortable bringing these up and talking about it. And I guess, you know, in the fire service, when we have the after-action review as part of ICS, we have the National Near-Miss System, we have tailboard talks, you know, at company levels. We have all these different ideas on how to have these discussions. In the fire service, are they working? You know, do we use them to their fullest extent? Do we take these lessons? You know, if you have a company sit and discuss a call sitting on the tailboard, do those lessons get spread out across the other companies so they can learn from them? Or if we do an after-action review and say you have five companies in a fire, those five companies maybe are part of an after-action review. How do you share those that information with others? And so that's what the hospitals that were had created this learning environment were really good about sharing what they'd learned. They were good about recording the mistake and looking at the root cause. This is another piece of that, is looking at the root cause, looking at it. It wasn't just a process error where they tired, you know, because their shifts were too long, where they overworked because they were understaffed, where they have a rush of people at 7 o'clock at night and it caused them to be temporarily understaffed just because of this. You know, they were looking at organizational things that were in place that were outside of that nurse's or doctor's control that contributed to those errors. So it was interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting because you can look at that from the fire service point of view. Is, you know, the other day I was looking at, we had a couple of dispatches, and one was a grass fire, one was a structure fire, and there was like three medicals going on at the same time. Well, when they dispatched, by the time they got to dispatching the structure fire, there was only three engines left. That was it in our department. So now, it turned out not to be a big deal, but had it been a working fire, how do we start adjusting for that? What errors, you know, did that contribute to errors that were made because we're working outside of our norm? Because we get so used to working, you know, first engine pulls a line, second engine does water supply, the first truck company does ladders and search. You know, we have our routines, and if those routines get broken down because of call demand at that particular moment, how did that contribute to things happening on the fire ground that we didn't expect?
Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting about the psychological safety aspect that she talks about is it's very similar to stuff that we've written about and talked about for years that relates to crew resource management, human factors, and most of our stuff has been focused on increasing safety and performance as a crew, as a fire crew, as a professional fire crew, that you're going to be good at your job, you're going to know what you're doing, and you're going to work together effectively as a team so you do it safely. As a lot of what we've, again, talked about and written about over the years. And it's the same thing, but she's looking at it also now from the viewpoint of the happiness of the worker.
Yeah.
And we really haven't talked about that much in what we've done, but what she's saying in a lot of her stuff is they're actually happier as workers in those environments, so they stay there longer. And when you look at the competitive environment we have today, where we don't get the same number of fire applicants we used to, we're working harder and harder to get the applicants, and we are losing more people than we ever have before. And I don't mean that to sound dramatic. We're not mm-hmm. losing a lot of people, but we're used to losing hardly anybody, and now we see 1, 2, 3, 4 people a year go on to other things. Nothing against them. That's great. I'm happy for them. But it also then creates more turnover for us and more openings, and then we need more applicants. And so when you look at that aspect of it on a bigger scale, that's very important that we learn from that so that we can help retain these people too.
Well, and
keep them happy.
On the, you know, on the volunteer side of things, it's they're having trouble attracting volunteers and then keeping volunteers. And I mean, that's the backbone of the U.S. Fire Service, because so many towns, you know, are protected by volunteer fire departments. And if people want to do good for their community and they decide to volunteer for their fire departments, and they don't feel like they're making a difference, they don't feel like what they're contributing is respected. And it doesn't mean accepted, because not every idea that ever gets floated up is going to be able to be put into use, but at least respected and listened to, then they're going to move on to something else too. So I mean, it on both sides of the fence, it's an important aspect to keep people engaged.
Yep. Yeah, I like the kind of the two different aspects that were brought up in the TED Talk video that you showed, and we'll share the links on the website as well here too with the podcast. But there was also the article that she had, and they seemed to talk about two different aspects of the same psychological security. One is the employee satisfaction, and then the increase in productivity and performance that you get from those groups where you have a safe environment for people to bring up alternate ideas and to ask questions and to rethink what you're doing and why, and to explore alternate solutions or changing your identity or your culture or your values to reflect what your needs are instead of simply going along because that is what we do.
Right.
And so I found that part to be really interesting from that standpoint. And you can't have a single conversation in this day and age without bringing up COVID at some point in time. And we started off that way. But some of the ways that we need to look at adjusting how we deliver services or how we work or how we organize to minimize the impacts should COVID come into the workplace are ideas that we would have been absolutely laughed out of the station about in January of this year.
Right.
I mean, absolutely. And some organizations, having permanent station assignments is normal and it's the routine and it's not a big deal. And maybe in those organizations, you also have people that schlep from station to station to fill in openings and stuff. And that's one of the key ways you can have a rapid spread should somebody bring it into the workplace. But just changing how you do staffing to try to compartmentalize, to try to individualize and create separations so that when something comes in, it doesn't spread across the organization is the kind of thing that were hard to implement to begin with, valued when you see something come in that does start to affect it and makes you rethink, are there reasons we should maybe be doing this all the time and not just when this is over, we stop and go back to what we were doing? Was what we were doing the best way to do this? And maybe even this interim thing we're doing isn't the best way, not to say that it's harsh or less harsh, but to be able to step back and say, what's the best way to deliver this service? What's the best way to do this thing? Not just how have we always done it? And I see interesting things coming out of that. I see the struggles from some people to accept doing things differently or to accept a changing role that we might have now in that. But that it leads to a better organization probably when you're doing that, and hopefully a better and more productive workplace.
So I'm kind of curious, thinking about going off down a tangent here real quick. I'm just curious, so are you saying that there are some people who don't like being assigned to just one station?
I was going to say, you're a little vague with some of this.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So we're a smaller organization in Moorhead. We have only two fire stations with the outlook for a third coming down the road. And we believe as an organization mostly that when we achieve having a third fire station, we are going to have bidded permanent station assignments and a way to take care of when people are out sick and absent. But at the moment with two stations, our crews will rotate back and forth between the two. So if we're trying to maintain four firefighters at our second fire station, which would normally be three if we're not in the middle of ramping up to do a new station, but anyways, If you have somebody go out on an unexpected illness, you can just transplant somebody from a station that's got two or three crews working at it down there to bring them back up to their minimums, as well as they might work at that station for 2 months, and then they rotate back up to the other station and work there for 3 months, or for 3 or 4 weeks, and then go back down because somebody else is going to be gone for 2 weeks, and so it makes sense to make that person move, and that's just been part of our culture for long time.
I think it's interesting. The reason I asked that, I just wanted to make sure I was understanding that correctly, because in our department, people are more inclined to expect to stay at their station than they are to travel. And so the reason I wanted to make sure is, I mean, our two departments are split by, a 50-foot wide river?
Yep.
And we have two very different ways of operating. And I think to me it shows that in a lot of ways, what you expect is just what you're used to.
Oh, right.
You know, and so... You know, if somebody from Fargo was to go over to Moorhead, they'd be like, how come we're moving all the time? If someone from Moorhead came over to Fargo, they'd be like, how come we're staying still all the time? You know?
Now I got to figure out how Kevin likes to do this when he's the driver. Well, and then add on top of that, our firefighters are all drivers as well, too. So this tour, you might have been driving the engine. And the next tour, you might be jumping on the rescue truck, small little rescue truck. We split our four-person engine crew into two smaller rigs so we can go two directions if we need to. So you might have that happen, and partway through the tour, somebody leaves and another person comes in and is now the driver of the engine that was working uptown the other day before. So it's not as if you learn those intuitive things about how your three-person crew works.
Right.
That you just know, this is how my captain likes to see it, And when he's gone, this person fills in. That's how they like to see it. And that's all I got to know. I got those two guys figured out, and I'm good until we got to rebid the next year, and hopefully some more senior guy doesn't end up bumping me out of my station, that jerk, because I like working here. Right. But our folks are completely unaccustomed to that. However, we parked all of our crews, April, I think it was. Sometime in April, we stopped all movement of people between the stations. We made one adjustment in that because we didn't have key people where they needed to be. So we might have a captain at this station, but nobody else qualified to work as one. So if he's on vacation or sick, now what do we do? Right. And so we made one adjustment, parked people there, and they've been that way now since April, which seems like an eternity. May, June, July. It's only been... It's been 3 months, which for some is a long time, and for some is not all that long. But for a lot of people that have been parked in stations that don't have as many administrative folks working in, so our headquarters station has the administrative offices as well too. So there's always more politics going on between the 40-hour people and the shift people and different shifts and personalities, and so it's perhaps a little less dramatic to work at a station that's not your headquarters fire station. And so the crews that are working there have come to perhaps a new appreciation of staying at a station for a while. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both. But
I've always argued, I guess, made the point, I don't know if argue is the right word, but I've argued for the advocated. There's the word I should use. Advocated for keeping crews in their area. Because I remember I was at one station for 7 or 8 years. And it got to the point where I recognized the vehicles. I recognized faces. I recognized people. The alleys and behind the buildings, and the alarm panels, and everything inside. Now, the odd addresses that are addressed on an avenue, but the front door is actually on a street kind of thing. And so I think there's a lot of benefits to staying put, but there are some benefits to moving too, because you can get a little sedentary and a little just comfortable.
Right.
Maybe too comfortable. So I don't think it's bad to move every once in a while, but I think it's tough to find that balance sometimes, too.
And what if somebody from the outside said, I don't understand why you would do either of those ways?
Well, exactly.
Why don't you do it this way?
That's kind of the point where we started with this, as I was making, is what you're used to is what's comfortable, and sometimes you don't have to go very far to find something completely different.
Yeah, and perhaps it works better. I don't know, but you have to... But it's very... I can speak from personal experience that it's very difficult working in an environment where you feel if you forward an idea, whether it's good or not, that there's a significant chance of that coming back to bite you, that you are going to get belittled or you're going to get laughed at for bringing up the idea, ridiculed, scorned, or disregarded, or perhaps excluded from future things if you're vocal about what you think might be a good idea. Whereas what's really hard to cultivate is a culture where those ideas are brought up, and whether it happens in a very planned way, there's times where this is acceptable so that we can start to maybe gradually learn and grow into that culture. Okay, all right, second day of the tour, everybody. So this is our breakfast talk. We got the hour and a half where everything is cool. And when we're done with this, we put it all behind to start with. So other ideas can come out and you can explore them without ridicule. And in the end, you see what you want to carry forward, maybe think about it. Or you just say, we'll set them aside till the next time we're together. I don't know.
And that's kind of what happened in that article that we were talking about a few minutes ago, is that consultant was actually hired to come into this company and figure out why the culture was so toxic.
Right.
And the consultant went to one of the offices and said, we think the reason part of the reason why that the culture is so toxic is because you expect everybody to be in contact constantly, on the phone, email, whatever. So I'm coming to your office to ask for your permission to find a way to guarantee everybody at least one day off. So they know every week they're going to have Wednesday night off, or they know every week they're going to have Friday or whatever. And the first boss, the first store manager or whatever, said, no, get out of here. I don't want any of that, because their culture was that they had to be able to be contacted all the time. So then this consultant went to another office, found a younger guy, and as the article said, he had two kids, a third one on the way. He himself was trying to find this work-life balance that he didn't have, that he wanted to have, so he was open to this idea. And what was interesting was the office productivity went up, happiness went up, but it also set the stage so that this group could have those conversations you're talking about. Those, mm-hmm. those, they had time set aside and I think it was every week, where they could have those conversations, and everything was fair game. And not everything got accepted, but, you know, it was still, at least you could have that conversation and maybe put all those ideas together. You might come up with a good one, which is kind of the gist, you know, in general.
Right, and it started with approaching one problem or one issue.
Yeah.
And so at least there was a more grounded reference into that. Yeah, pick any particular one issue that's problematic that you figure if you change anything, the world is going to fall down. The sky is going to fall and everything's going to break. And they were able to work their way through that and change their perception that maybe you could survive with other changes as well, too, if
right.
done casually.
It was interesting to watch how that went, or how that evolved. It kind of feeds off itself. And so that's how Craig and I got talking a little bit, is because the fire service changed, because... You know, we've been writing about it. The three of us have been talking about it. There's other people out there that have been talking about the same kind of stuff. I mean, it's not a brand new topic. This mm-hmm. is crew resource management, leadership. I mean, leadership has been forever, but crew resource management is a little bit newer, but it's not brand new. In our careers, in our time that we've been in the fire service, have there been changes? Because there have been pushes. What was it, the conference that... We mentioned at one point that actually recognized CRM as one of the things we should be using was in 2001 or 2002, I want to say. That's a really vague reference, so I don't know if you're going to remember what I'm talking about. But, you know, roughly 20 years ago, these things were recognized as needing to happen. Mm-hmm. Has there been a change in 20 years?
Looking at it as individuals, or the three of us together, like you said, we've written about it. We've talked about it a lot. We've tried it, I think, at work over the years. Has there been movement on it? Have we moved, or are we still in the same? And I don't think we're in the same spot, but I also don't think we're probably as far as I would have liked to have seen us get in the last 10 years, 15 years, mm-hmm. 20 years.
I also like the other aspect that you led off with in the video, where one of the keys to make the hospitals higher performing, and I don't know that they actually said this. They hinted at perhaps there were better patient outcomes, but I don't know that that was actually part of the talk.
I can't remember either for sure. I feel like I was going to say the same thing earlier, and I couldn't remember, but I feel like they hinted at it also.
It feels like it would have to be a part of that. But creating a culture where it's okay to say something if you see something that you think is wrong, or if you see something that you think is not what was intended to be happening. And that's maybe a better way to put it, because if you talk about pointing out something your boss is doing wrong, or something your boss is about to do wrong, or something that your boss isn't doing that they're supposed to, or that they forgot or they overlooked, that's a whole different thing than saying, I think I see something that the boss would wanted to have considered in this, but must have missed, or thought it was a different way, or I could also be off, but I'd feel bad if I didn't at least bring this up. And so how you create that culture where it's not about the right and wrong, but hey, did you catch this thing that I just saw? And maybe it happened so quickly that I'm the one who saw it and nobody else did, and you're like, oh crap, yeah, let's think about that. Or, oh no, I saw it, but it happened three other times and it's because of this, that, and that. I've seen this like six different times, and okay, that's good, I just wanted to make sure, because it falls into that CRM of disregarding the input that falls out of the norm by saying, well, most of the time nothing goes wrong. Most of the time they do have it covered, and I'm just being weird or paranoid and not listening to that little voice that says, this doesn't seem right.
Well, and that goes back to the Swiss cheese model in a lot of ways. Yeah, that one thing that person is seeing by itself might not be an issue, but when all those, you know, when you get two or three or four, whatever number of circumstances it takes, when they do finally line up, that's when stuff goes wrong. But people are afraid to speak up because they want to be looked upon as troublemakers. You know, there's self-preservation.
Yeah. And she kind of talks about that in there, how this starts happening at a young age. This happens in our childhood. We learn real early on in school and other environments, well, don't stick your neck out if you don't need to, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the safe thing to do. So then you remain safe. You don't go through any ridicule. You don't get made fun of. All that's picked on, etc. And in a lot of environments, it's all right. And just like you said, Dane, with the Swiss cheese, it gets by because it's not a life-threatening event. But when you fly a jet airliner, mistakes can be very costly, so you don't have a lot of room for them. When you fight fires and you're in an ideal H, you don't have a lot of room for error in an ideal H. Those are the environments then where it's that much more important that we understand these concepts and we're working as a team and we're comfortable, because you're fighting against, again, years worth of habits. We talked about with COVID how hard it is to overcome habits that we've built up over the last 40, 50 years. How you greet someone and how you say goodbye to them, and had to change that now in the last few months, and how difficult that is. It's that difficult to change these behaviors in ourselves. And Dane and I were talking a little bit just before you got here, Jeff, about when we were talking about has this changed? And I commented, well, I know at least in our recruit classes, we don't tell them to shut up and not speak. We actually encourage them to speak. But I also wouldn't go so far as to say that we spend probably the amount of time and effort we need to truly get them to speak up. I think you really have to emphasize it, and you have to push it, and then you have to make them practice it to break years of habits.
Yeah, you have to actually design scenarios around and practice the art of intervening when you feel you see something wrong. Yeah, so that you're developing that habit. And, you know, I know that some people are worried about second-guessing your supervisor, whether it's your bat chief or your captain, to throw it out there. There's a difference between the, hey, I'm not going in there, that's crap, because I think this thing's going to come down to, hey, Cap, did you see the smoke pulling back out of there real quick and sucking in? You know, it's the difference between pointing out something that seems wrong or out of line versus saying, no way, I'm not doing that, this is unsafe, you don't know what's going on with the smoke. It's that you're part of a team and you're pointing out an indicator that maybe was seen or missed. Yeah. And that it's a subtle distinction, but that really plays into working together as a team. And you're actually covering each other. You're actually covering your supervisor, and they you by, if anybody sees something that seems a little weird, you just throw it out there. And the captain's still making a decision, right? Mm-hmm. You haven't taken that decision-making process away, and you're not insubordinate, and you're not striking out on your own just to make that observation and doing that thing on the way into it. Hey, Cap, did you see the smoke come out of there? And it's like a whoop right back in, and it can, and the reaction time is pretty quick as well, too. Ah, shit, let me check over here on the corner, or... Oh, yep, caught that, and I got this. Let's go hit real quick over here. We're not going in that way. Oh, okay. And your interaction is done, and you're still moving, and you're still working, and you're still bringing your tools to where you're doing while that's happening. Okay. So,
what's the smoke sound like when it goes back in?
Yeah, it goes in and goes whoosh, right back in. And I probably said it different. It depends on the velocity. Sometimes it's just whoosh, and then sometimes it's whoosh, and you're sort of, hey, that doesn't seem right. Hmm.
But no,
the fire eats, it lives, it breathes. You pulled that out of me, Dave.
Yeah, yeah.
You have nobody to blame but yourself. And it hates. We're really old. There's a lot of young guys going, what the hell are they even talking about?
But I mean, you make a good point. It's to everybody's benefit. It's going to make the entire crew perform at a higher level.
Yeah.
And... time, you know, that happens time and again, that builds a reputation. And so that's the interesting part. One of the things I got from studying organizational behavior, one of the things I thought was really interesting to me was that high performance team isn't one that has a lot of high performers on it. It's what happens with a high performance team is you put a group of people together and they set goals for themselves and they try to keep beating their own goals. They try to keep becoming better, and they know from doing that that the only way that they can keep getting better is to keep challenging themselves and to pick out those things. Hey, if you'd pulled the hose, if you'd flaked it this way with these two folds instead of these two folds, it would have gone 2 seconds faster. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. Well, that builds that communication that you have to have. That builds that communication that if it makes them, it builds an environment where they want to speak up. Because they want to be the best crew on the fire
brigade. I'd even argue that they learn that the team is their strength. That by working together, they improve, and they can improve further. And that's, of course, the Miracle on Ice is one of the first things that popped in my mind when you said that. Because Herb Brooks, that was one of the things when he was recruiting or picking his hockey players, they were not necessarily the hockey players that everybody else would have picked. And he said, but they were on winning teams, but they weren't the standouts. They were guys that worked together well. He wanted mm-hmm. people that were team players.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the, probably the most incredible stories ever to achieve that level of greatness. So I think you put it again back to that team concept is so critical to everything we do.
Sure. And you know what sports teams garner the most attention and admiration from people across the country, whether they're your team or not? The team that year after year after year has four or five star players because they got them, you know, they got huge payroll and they can do that and you just go yeah, whatever. Or the team that has relatively few, if any, standouts, but for some reason this season that baseball team is on fire and they can't pick two. It's because that one person is hitting like a crazy guy, or they got that pitcher that's just unbelievable. But they've got a whole group of fairly decent players that all come together and they're just kicking ass over everybody else because of that high-performing team and the interactions that are going on back and forth. And that's all okay. They're covering each other, performing better and challenging each other.
Well, that's what, like when Gardenhire was the manager of the Twins, to get local for a second, but Gardenhire was the manager of the Twins a few years ago, and they didn't have any, at the time, they didn't have any big names. You know, they had good players. They had Joel Nathan, they had Kadir, they had, I can't think of the first baseman's name, but anyways, they had some good players. They were solid. But they played really well together as a team, and they did well. I mean, I don't remember how far they went that particular year. I don't remember things like that. But they were fun to watch. They were having a good time, and they did well because they could play together as a team. Versus you take the Yankees or somebody like that that has one or two very well known across the world probably type players, and yeah, they always do well also. But if that one player gets hurt or is gone that night or something, then you can see that affect the way the team has this ebbs and flows with those one or two players.
Yeah, you can see it in the energy. You can see it in the motivation there. And you can tell that all together, they're all playing well above what they're individually capable of working together in that group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, the Twins brought Valencia up from their minor league team, put him on third base, and he was able to fit in because he was a good team player. That particular year, he played awesome. Like you said, that other players brought him up and they could play well together. And that same thing goes on the fire ground. If you put a group of firefighters together who want to excel, they're going to have that communication, that learning environment that Amy Emmonson talks about is that communication is there to make each other better. And it's accepted as constructive criticism instead of as a negative critique.
Yep. So, how do you replicate that in your own fire station?
I think, like you said, Jeff, I think we got to put it into practice. And that when you said that, that kind of hit me. That shows me we're not there. We talk about it. We talk about it with the recruits. But your officers need to understand the concepts, because when somebody brings this up, when a new person brings this up to them, they need to understand what's happening, not that this person's being insubordinate, that this person is trying to be a part of the team and just asking. Like you said, that officer still has control of that situation, still has to make the decisions, still responsible for the decisions, but this person is just trying to help and be a part of that team. Both sides need that practice on the fire ground. We need to be running evolutions where we put that into play and we force new guys to say things over the radio, to even to report information to command. That's important. But to talk to their officers and, I see this, is this okay, or do you see that? So that both sides know how to do it, because then the new person needs to know, you can teach them how to do it politically correct or politely so that they don't, because if they're not good at it or practice with it, it may come across as offensive or as being insubordinate, and that may not be what they mean, but they haven't practiced it and been taught how to do it. So I think that's the key, is when you're at an organization that's putting that into practice, then I think you're reaching that.
Well, we did that in one department probably 7-8 years ago. They specifically asked us. They had us come out, and we taught the CRM class, so everybody on the department had the theory. And then they had a house they were going to burn down, and we did, I don't remember how many different scenarios, but the chief specifically asked us, I want you to build CRM situations, you know, situations where younger firefighters were forced to speak up into those evolutions. And it was interesting to watch the behaviors, and it went well. But, I mean, until you do that day in and day out in your training, it doesn't become a normal behavior. It's a one-off kind of thing where, I'm aware of that. Yeah, we did that one time, but it's not something that you do out of habit.
Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to the other end of the discussion on the brainstorming new ideas or trying to rethink your processes, and where those ideas are acceptable outside of the fire ground scene where you're looking to have the recognition of issues, I think you start slow, you start small. You start with one focused problem or area that you're trying to solve, and you intentionally try to solve it in a non-traditional manner.
Yeah.
They had the ideal there where you can bring in a consultant to come in and try to teach you that. Not all of us have that luxury, and maybe we don't think it would be well perceived if that happens or even have that kind of a resource available to us. But trying to find one thing where you're going to say, we are going to be different on this, and here's the times we're going to try to be different, and then we're going to come back to it and see how it works to see if that starts to grow a plant that'll maybe...
I think you nailed it right there. Whether it worked or not is hard for me to say because I was part of what happened, but I feel like it was good. But exactly what you said is the engine I worked on, we were all hotels and commercial and apartment buildings. There was very few single-family dwellings in the area that we covered. So we always did what our department calls a reverse lay, which is a 2.5 with a gated Y to a floor below the fire and then an 1¾-inch attack line. So we figured, okay, you know what? When we pull holes, this is what we pull 99% of the time. We're going to nail this thing every time. We want it to be fast. We want it. And we did get it down. We got it. We kept playing with it. Like you said, kind of thinking out of the box, how can we make this a little bit faster? How can we make that a little bit faster? And so we were timing ourselves. And we got it down to where we were pulling a 100-foot, that was more than that, I think. Anyways, we had to, where we could do the reverse lay in under a minute. And that gained us a little bit of recognition so that the training division would call us to have us come teach the new firefighters the reverse lay because they recognized the company as being proficient in that skill. And that builds pride. And so these things evolve. And as that pride builds, it can start spreading out to other things as well. And so I think you nailed it there. Start on something focused that's really important to that company, something that they do most often that other companies will notice that they do well, so they can take a little bit of pride in it and take pride in the working for that company. That's where that communication really gets built up, I think.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, this would be the point in time in the podcast where we'd like to encourage people to come out to FDIC.
This would be about the time where we'd be encouraging them to sign up for the scholarship.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this would be the point in time in the broadcast where we would encourage people to look inward at your departments if you can't look outward and challenge yourselves to find something new to approach and find something to reinvent within the organization. Maybe try this technique out. But if you can't innovate from the outside, innovate from a distance and innovate with a lot of internal thought and discussion. So perhaps you can turn your own fire department into a mini FDIC this year where you challenge a few people to go out and get outside ideas off the web, the internet, YouTube, bring them in and see what changes you can make internally. Maybe for 1 year you'll be a little more effective doing that, assuming we're all allowed to train with each other 3 weeks from now. Or train in-house, you know.
Right.
So many variables there. But otherwise, keep the faith till we get back to the new normal or till we figure out what this normal is right now and we continue to adapt like we have to everything else that has changed in the fire service. And I guess we'll see you again in September.
Sounds good.
Yep.
Be safe.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Tailboard Talk. Don't forget to tune in each week, Monday through Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 8:30 p.m. Pacific, for Fire Engineering Talk Radio. You can also subscribe to all of our shows on iTunes. Just search for Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Check out our educational programs and consultation services. They're all available at tailboardconsulting.com. There you can find links to all of our shows and our magazine articles. Thanks for listening and join us again next month for another episode of Tailboard Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio.